For second graders at the Emma E. Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida, it was an unbelievable moment. Here they were, reading for the President of the United States. For George W. Bush, it was also an unbelievable moment. Sitting on a stool in the classroom, doing a photo opportunity for the media, his face was frozen in suppressed shock. All the president could think about was what an aide had just whispered in his ear.
A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack.
George W. Bush had been in the White House for less than 8 months. Tuesday, September the 11th, 2001, redefined his presidency. It also set America's course for years to come. The new president had drifted during his first months in office. He didn't seem to have a firm agenda in domestic policy, and overseas his line was more cautious than that of the Clinton administration, which had got entangled in messy peacekeeping operations in Africa and the Balkans. During the election campaign, Bush had set out his concerns.
I'm worried about overcommitting our military around the world. Our military is meant to fight and win war. That's what it's meant to do. And when it gets overextended, morale drops. I'm going to be judicious as to how to use the military. It needs to be in our vital interest. The mission needs to be clear and the exit strategy obvious.
But all this was before September the 11th. At 9:30 that morning, Bush spoke briefly to the media at the school in Florida.
Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country. I have ordered that the full resources of the federal government go to help the victims and their families and to conduct a full-scale investigation to hunt down and to find those folks who committed this act. Terrorism against our nation will not stand.
Commentators noted that his line about terrorism was an echo, conscious or not, of what his father had said 11 years earlier, before the Gulf War.
This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait.
To many observers, in fact, George W. Bush, known as W., seemed out of his depth in the White House. His verbal gaffes were notorious, his Texan cowboy image seemed crude, and he was widely assumed to be under the thumb of strong advisers. In reality, however, Bush was his own man. After a dissolute drunken youth, he became a born-again Christian and renounced alcohol, evidence of his strong willpower. Bush delegated widely, but made up his own mind. Christopher Meyer, the British ambassador in Washington, stressed 2 points about Bush in messages back to London.
Firstly, he was smart as a whip. Secondly, he would view events, countries and people in black and white, good and bad, friendly and hostile, loyal and unreliable. Verbal stumbles notwithstanding, this was someone not to be underestimated. He was, after all, the only Texas governor to be elected to consecutive 4-year terms.
The problem was that nothing could have prepared any president for September the 11th, 2001. It was a day like no other in U.S. history.
We heard a big bang, and then we saw smoke coming out, and everybody started running out.
I saw chunks of debris just falling down because I was close to the window. It was unbelievable.
The nearest equivalent, Pearl Harbor in 1941, was an assault 2,000 miles from the continental United States, which itself remained virtually unscarred by World War II. In 2001, however, Bush was facing an attack of unknown scope at the heart of America's finance and government. Two hijacked planes destroying the giant twin towers of the World Trade Center near Wall Street, another plane plowing into the Pentagon, nerve center of America's defenses, and a fourth finally forced down by courageous passengers en route for the White House itself. Bush struggled to find his touch. It didn't help that he wasn't allowed back to Washington till that evening because of fears of more terrorist attacks. There followed what Time magazine called
2 days in which Bush blinked his way through teleprompted remarks like a schoolboy reciting his lessons. In one of those staged events that are designed to look candid but fail utterly, he paced behind his desk during a photo op phone call with Mayor Rudy Giuliani of New York, accepting the mayor's invitation to tour his city's wreckage. Bush looked like a nervous teenager making weekend plans.
On the Friday, the president spoke at a special service at Washington National Cathedral, the eyes of the country upon him. It was an occasion for national solidarity, Democrats and Republicans together. But the loneliness of leadership was palpable. Time magazine commented,
"Every history book tells us how war renders a president an island unto himself. Bush's father had the same people around him during Desert Storm, but he bore the solitary burden of a president at war." On Friday, at the Washington National Cathedral, after the president delivered his homily, Bush Sr. reached over to squeeze his son's hand, his eyes not looking at him but raised toward the heavens. Like few others, he knows that the president is on his own.
The service was held at lunchtime. Afterwards, the president flew up to Manhattan for his first visit since the attacks. The Twin Towers had collapsed, but the rubble was still on fire with a giant plume of smoke. Staffers on the chopper flying into Manhattan sniffed the smell of burning 20 miles out. Later, journalist Bob Woodward talked with the president and recorded his impressions of that dark, smoldering wasteland.
Along with destruction far worse than anything he had seen on television or heard about from his advisors, he encountered a crowd of rescue workers hungry for revenge. One pointed to him as he walked by and yelled out,
"Don't let me down!"
Bush was stunned. He thought that the words and look on the man's face would perhaps stay with him forever.
"Don't let me down."
This was so personal, he thought. It was as if he were in some ancient arena. The rescue workers began chanting,
"USA! USA!
So George W. Bush was cast as America's gladiator. But his aides were totally unprepared. They had no plans for a speech. No sound equipment was in place. This was simply a visit to meet rescue workers. Yet clearly the president had to say something. Nearby was a charred fire truck. Bush was helped on top of it, and somebody found a white megaphone.
"I want you all to know that America today is on bended knee in prayer for the people whose lives were lost here, for the workers who work here, for the families who mourn. This nation stands with the good people of New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut as we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens." "I can hear you!" "I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you! And the people... and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
At last, the President of the United States had found his voice. New Yorkers didn't want to be told that their nation was still on bended knee. They wished to know that America's attackers would soon be getting it where it really hurt. Over the weekend, the president and his advisers planned their response. By now, it was clear that the attacks had been conducted by Al-Qaeda, a collection of radical Islamic cells headed by Osama bin Laden. It was also clear that he was being sheltered by the fundamentalist Taliban regime in Afghanistan. On September the 20th, Bush, now at his most presidential, addressed Congress. he alluded to the remarkable wave of sympathy that had surged around the globe.
America will never forget the sounds of our national anthem playing at Buckingham Palace, on the streets of Paris, and at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate. We will not forget South Korean children gathering to pray outside our embassy in Seoul, or the prayers of sympathy offered at a mosque in Cairo.
But Bush's main message was for his fellow countrymen and women.
Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
The phrase "war on terror" was deliberately open-ended. A war rather than merely a campaign. Waged not against specific terrorist groups, but against terror itself. Because terror threatened everything that America stood for.
Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what they see right here in this chamber. A democratically elected government. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other. This is not, however, just America's fight. And what is at stake is not just America's freedom. This is the world's fight. This is civilization's fight. This is the fight of all who believe in progress and pluralism, tolerance and freedom. The course of this conflict is not known, yet its outcome is certain. Freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them.
Not only had Bush found his voice, America had found a new enemy, a new evil against which to define itself after the end of the Soviet Union. Cynically, one might say that in September 2001, the Bush administration needed a focus, needed an enemy. But that doesn't do justice to the searing effect of 9/11 on American opinion and on the president himself, especially the sights, sounds and smells of Ground Zero. With 3,000 dead, this was by far the worst foreign attack against American soil, directed at two of its most iconic buildings. Yet passion has its dangers in politics and in diplomacy. 9/11 drove Bush into Afghanistan with worldwide support. It also impelled him into Iraq, where the story was very different.